What's Next from American Security Project? I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today, I'm joined by ASP's chairperson, Governor Christine Todd Whitman. Governor Whitman is currently president of the Whitman Strategy Group, but of course, before that, the former governor of the great state of New Jersey and administrator of the EPA. Governor Whitman, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Governor Whitman, I think a lot of people know you now outside of the EPA, outside of New Jersey, for a very strong stance on climate and energy security. What made those two things so important to you?
Well, it's watching what's been happening in the world and the impact that human behavior has had on our environment, and understanding that what it poses is a very real security, both at home in the sense of our physical security, because clean air, as we know, and every study that comes out tells us one more thing that clean air does to us for our health, our quality of life, but also internationally, where you have displaced persons, because what are you going to do with people in countries that don't exist anymore because they're underwater? In this country, in Alaska, we're already seeing the native Alaskans, some of them having to move from their traditional homes further inland because of the sea level rise. You've seen along the coast people having to make decisions about what's going to happen, not way down the line in the future, but in the next 4 or 5 years. So it is a major issue. When you combine it with what happens in countries which is unfortunately where a lot of this takes place, that don't necessarily have the most stable governments, and you suddenly have displaced people with whom they have to deal. You have people who are in the inland, in sub-Sahara, who are nomadic and trying to move their herds around to find water, and they can't, and so they're moving into other countries. It's destabilizing, and it is a place where when people do things like move into the cities because they can't make a living anymore in the country, they can't survive. Overcrowding the cities, the joblessness rises, and that's a perfect recruiting ground for terrorists. So this is an issue that is of paramount importance in my mind for a whole host of reasons.
Sure. And while climate and energy certainly pose significant risks and changes with climate, we've discussed, have real impacts, they're also really interesting leverage points. And a lot of what you do now focuses on technology, recognizing climate and energy as a way to make positive change. Are there certain technologies you're more excited about or have more faith in than others?
Well, there's a lot of good work being done in a host of alternative energy systems, shall we say. But we have one right now. We have a base power right now that provides over 63% of our clean power, while only really providing 19% of our overall power mix, and that's nuclear energy. So I am a strong proponent of nuclear continuing the current role that it has, at least keeping it at 19 to 20% of our energy as we move forward, because frankly, we can't meet the needs that we have established as too far as reducing our carbon emissions and in the time frame that we have signed on to, whether it be COP21, the Paris Accord, or under the Clean Power Plan. We can't do that with renewables alone. And we need to start working with states to help them understand for their regulatory approach should be about clean power, not picking the winners and losers, and not limiting it just to renewables. But clean power is what we want, and that would extend the umbrella to nuclear, which is the only form of base power that releases no pollutants while it's producing power. And that's important, because what many people don't realize is wind and solar are wonderful, very small part of our overall mix today, but they can get to be more.
Sure.
But they're not base. They're not 24-7, right. And we're a 24-7 society.
Absolutely.
It's also the new generation of small modular reactors hold great promise for other parts of the world where you don't have access to the grid, that are more rural. Even in this country, and again in Alaska and parts of the West that are not on a grid, with a small modular reactor, you can build it on site. It's faster to build, easier to build, more secure, less component parts, easier to secure for that reason. And you can just have it there, and it will provide power for a town or a community. So there's a lot going on in that field, and there are also new ways of getting at the power source, getting at uranium. They're looking at extraction of uranium from salt water.
Wow.
There are molten salt reactors as a way to produce nuclear energy. So there are lots of exciting things happening in the field of nuclear energy, and we have a track record. We understand how nuclear energy works. In this country, it's been enormously safe. We have one of the gold standards in oversight through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So it's something that we would want to export, because there are some 60 nuclear reactors being built around the world right now.
Sure.
And another at least 60 that are being contemplated in countries that have terrific air quality issues, China, India, Vietnam. And so they're looking at moving forward. And I'd like to see our technology, United States technology, be the sources to which they go, not just because it would be good for our economy, but also I happen to think that our standards are pretty high.
Yeah.
And I trust them more than I would necessarily the Russian standards.
I happen to agree with you. I think you have a particularly interesting kind of ability to deal with the controversy or people who are against nuclear, right? Because not only were you a governor, you were also running the EPA. So you can talk about and understand governors who have very serious concerns about bringing nuclear waste into their state, the long-term environmental impacts. So how does that experience lead you to say, no, nuclear needs to be a part of our energy security?
Well, I was also president of our State Board of Public Utilities in New Jersey for a number of years. So I've dealt with nuclear from several different levels, as a BPU, as a governor on the PJM, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey grid, which has nuclear reactors.
Interesting.
And as a head of the EPA. So I've seen it, been to reactors, walked them, understand how they work. And really what you say to what I've been doing for the last 10 years really is trying to get into communities where there's an interest in nuclear, either because there's a reactor proposed or there's a relicensing issue, and answer people's questions. Let them ask the tough questions about security, about the spent rods. And when we talk about the spent rods, I like to tell people, look, we've had over 100 nuclear reactors at one point, 104 reactors. They've operated for better than 50 years now. If you took all the spent rods from all those reactors and put them end to end, you'd fill up one football field to the height of the goalposts. That's what you're talking about, not something the size of the state of Maine,
right?
Which is how many people think of it. It's also not a liquid or a gas in those rods. It's pellets. And while you wouldn't want to stand next to them, should one be breached, you're not going to get a sudden release into the atmosphere or into the groundwater. And they're all now stored safely on site, either in underground holding ponds, but most of them have been moved to above ground steel and concrete reinforced bunkers. And for every 10 tons of nuclear waste, it's 100 tons of cement and steel surrounding that.
Wow.
So they are really safe on site, but that's not ideal because they're positioned throughout the country. And the Congress determined that a long time ago, and they said there should be one repository, and that repository, after a look, should be Yucca Mountain in Nevada. That's been politics that has stopped that, not science.
Sure.
It's not a problem. We as taxpayers and ratepayers have spent literally billions of dollars in getting Yucca Mountain site ready to receive nuclear waste, and it's ready.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at the EPA, it was a time when we had to determine what kind of water quality standard we would impose and require them to meet. And it was a difference between the surface water, safe water, or drinking water standard, clean water standard or the drinking water standard. And I picked the drinking water standard because that was a more difficult standard to meet, but I still felt that they could meet it. And, in fact, every study has shown that they would meet it, that it would be safe for drinking water, and now it's up to a million years, which is ridiculous because technology is going to change things so dramatically. Within 10 years, you don't know what you're going to be dealing with. So that's a perfect place. And the other side of it is that you have within those spent rods between 95 and 97% unused energy or fissionable material. In both France and Japan, they have worked out a process whereby they can access that energy, leave between 3 and 5% of residue, as it were, and ensure that that can never be weapons grade. It's highly enriched plutonium at the end of that process, but it can never be weapons grade. And so we need to get back in the business of looking at reprocessing, recycling the energy, which would vastly reduce how much we have to store anywhere and what the shelf life of that would be.
And you've mentioned there are, of course, security concerns to having our spent fuel rods dispersed across the country. Being able to secure those, not just should someone or some actor want to access them, but also for environmental reasons. But we've also talked a little bit about exporting technology. And there are great benefits to that. As you said, you know, our standards are the gold standard.
Right.
And we would rather have our technology out there than the Russian technology. Do you think there are true security concerns to exporting nuclear technology, or are they just sort of what it looks like rather than what it is?
I think it's more perception than reality. And frankly, the world's going ahead with nuclear, whether
right.
we're part of that or not. It's
right.
it's happening. My point is only that our regulatory system is so protective that I'd rather have that be the standard used in other countries than
mm-hmm.
what the Russians or the Chinese might use.
Absolutely.
Nothing against them personally, but I just
right.
think our standards have been proven over time to be the most protective. And the kind of, if you look at the record here of safety in this country at reactors, it's been extraordinarily good.
Right.
The worst problem we had was Three Mile Island,
mm-hmm.
and that was a partial meltdown in the core, the irony being that if the operators had let the reactor do what it was programmed to do, it wouldn't have had that problem, but they
right.
overrode it, and that's what caused the issues. But for those operators who were in the reactor at the time standing near it, there was no overexposure to radiation, and they
right.
have been monitored since then for the decades since then, and there are no cancer clusters there. So while it was a serious mishap and not
mm-hmm.
anything that you want to have happen,
right.
It did not ever pose a threat to the community at large. And that was back before, it was a wake-up call for the industry.
Right.
And procedures were changed dramatically after that. And now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission maintains two independent scientists on every site where there are nuclear reactors with 24/7 access to those reactors. And they are constantly monitoring and security. They're constantly challenging the utilities to see if they can be breached to ensure that safety of those facilities. So it is something where we have had an extraordinarily good history of safety in this country, not to say that there aren't issues from time to time,
sure.
but most of the ones when people get excited are self-reported by the utilities because they are required to do such stringent monitoring, and none of them have ever risen to, that I know of, have ever risen to the level of a human health threat. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the concentrations haven't been at that level. They've been small, but you can never say never.
Right.
And so you have to be careful and ever vigilant, and the utilities understand that, as does the NRC, and that's what they're trying to guard against.
And do you think there are places, whether within the United States or other countries, allies or not, where nuclear power wouldn't be an appropriate choice?
I don't think nuclear is for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be up to those countries and those states, those communities, to determine what is going to be right for them. There's a trade-off on every form of energy that you impose or
mm-hmm.
that you have, that you access. People don't want, you like natural gas, it's nice and cheap now, but nobody wants a pipeline near them because they blow up.
Right.
One of my first disasters right after I'd been elected governor was a pipeline explosion
yeah.
in Edison that leveled a building. It looked
yeah.
like a bomb site. Well, it was an explosion site. Fortunately, nobody was there at the time, so they were all at work, so nobody was hurt. But still, you know, and
yeah.
birds don't look the same way when they come out of windmills as they did going in. So
right,
there are
exactly.
trade-offs on every form of power you can consider. And the important thing is for people to have the information they need to make an informed decision. Because by definition, if you don't have information, you can't make an
right.
informed decision.
It's the basics of economics. How are we supposed to do
and,
anything?
We need to be able to answer the questions for people so they can make that kind of informed decision.
I think a lot of people, especially the general public outside of the Beltway, outside of DC, they think of nuclear and they think of one kind of energy. But nuclear encapsulates a lot of different ways of getting nuclear energy, right? We've talked about small modular reactors. I also know you've spent some time looking at fusion projects. And while not your area of expertise per se, what do you think, is there a role separate from big nuclear for fusion? Is it part of nuclear?
I think there will be. I think there will be a role for fusion. It's the standard joke. Fusion is 20 years away.
Always. And
it's always 20 years away. We're getting closer, though, to the end of that process, and closer because of some of the plasma physics labs and what they've been able to produce to getting a scalable model. So I think there's going to be a role for it. It'll be separate, I believe, from nuclear overall. Mm-hmm. That's going to go its own way. But, you know, we're looking at every different form of energy, and that's great. That's as we should. There is no one answer to our energy needs, both either in this country or around the world. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to be as creative as we possibly can. And we need to understand that as we make the shift away from the fossil burning dirtier fuels, we also have to realize that we have an obligation to help those people who are going to be losing their jobs and livelihoods because of that.
Right.
And figure out, how do we help them? What do we do to give them the means to continue living where they've been living for, in some instances, generations?
Right. And through, you know, your work in the last 10 years, what do you think excites you the most about nuclear? What makes you really kind of so wholeheartedly get behind it?
Because it's a base power, 24/7 power, highly reliable. The nuclear reactors run at about 91% efficiency, and they're running all the time. The investment in them, while upfront costs are large, once up and running on a per kilowatt basis for the consumer, they're one of the least expensive forms of power, that they are the bridge that we're going to need between now and when the renewables are fully able to be deployed 24/7.
Right.
They are the solar works when the sun shines, wind works when the wind blows.
Sure.
We also need to get the challenges that those two forms of power also face is the footprint.
Right.
We have to be able to shrink those footprints. It now, for a nuclear reactor at 1,100 or 1,000 megawatts, 1,000 to 1,100 megawatts, takes a little over 1 square mile. Most of that is buffer. To get the same amount of power from a solar, you're talking 25 to 36 square miles.
That's enormous.
For wind, it's 260 to 360 square miles.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's a real problem for them. That's a challenge. And we'll get that down. They'll get more efficient. We have to figure out how to store that power. But until we get there, we need to have the bridge. And while natural gas is a lot less polluting than coal, and that's good. And, of course, right now it is very inexpensive, so it's appropriate to take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. But we shouldn't let nuclear get so far behind that we're not going to be able to keep using that very important form of 24/7 clean power.
Absolutely. And looking more broadly at maybe separately climate and energy, though they are so interdependent and interconnected, what concerns you the most in terms of the risks and impacts we face from climate change and our current energy strategy?
Well, what concerns me the most is we don't have an overall national energy plan, and we're not taking, at least in Washington, they're not taking the issue of climate change seriously enough. The public gets it. Every poll that you do shows that overwhelmingly the public realizes and says the climate is changing and humans have an impact.
Right.
And then when you do, well, does government have a responsibility to respond to that? And the answer is overwhelmingly yes.
Right.
We need to have government action in order to deal with this issue. And until we can marry those things, we're going to be in trouble.
Mm.
And that really does worry me.
And what do you think is what do we do about it, right? I think it worries a lot of people. It's a lot of what ASP focuses on. And some people, some elected leaders, some unelected leaders are more willing to go out on that limb. I think it's silly we still call it a limb, than others. And how do we encourage people that this is the right way forward? It is, you know, time to actually do something.
Well, again, I'd say that the public out there gets it, and that's why the activity you're going to see moving forward is at the municipal and state levels.
Mm-hmm.
A number of the states, even though the Clean Power Plan as proposed by the Environmental Protection Agency has been put on hold by the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. there are some 20 states that are already working right. on how they would meet those specific CPP goals. There are other states that are just working on how to, in general, do we reduce our carbon footprint. And it's pressure from the public, and we have to be able to make it relevant to the public why they should care about clean air, which that's climate change is driven by that. So I don't care why people do the right thing as long as they do it.
Right.
And if it's talking about clean air, healthier lifestyles, every study that you see that comes out, there's yet another study that says the bad impacts of
Absolutely.
Dirty air, what it means for asthma, those who suffer from asthma, yeah. particularly children, premature deaths, cancer, heart attacks, all those things you can yeah. link back to dirty air. Eye problems now. There's another study talking about eyes. And, of course, the one that I think is going to get a lot of people's attention is a British study that is actually a real study that says that the pollution adds to premature aging in the face.
Wrinkles that'll get everybody.
Wrinkles and age spots.
So
and,
there you,
know, you
go.
And in fact, the cosmetic industry is trying very hard to figure out what kind of protection can we offer, because what you use for UV rays is not going to prevent and protect against pollution. Pollution is there in your face every day and you're wearing it.
And so interesting.
That's something that's really good. But we have to use those kinds of examples to make it make people understand this is real and it does affect you here and now, because the issue sounds so esoteric and so big that the average person doesn't kind of get their head around it. And then we need to say, and you need to support your leaders who want to look at this issue. And that's what I've been part of, co-chairing something called the Clean Safe Energy Coalition that's over 4,000 members now, and that's everything from individuals to organizations to, you know, chambers of commerce, labor unions, healthcare groups. And the whole purpose there, one of the purposes besides getting the information out about nuclear and working hand in hand with groups such as the American Security Project, who take it on from the American security aspect, what it really means to us, is also to have strength in numbers so that when the policymakers come to decide the type of energy mix they want, they can look over their shoulder and see that their respected opinion leader saying, you're not crazy to consider nuclear as part of this.
Right. Somebody has your back.
Has your back.
So our last question always on what's next is, in fact, what's next? And so, Governor Whitman, I pose that question to you. What's next for us in terms of climate and energy strategy, lack of strategy? What does the world look like in 20 years?
Well, I'm not sure anyone can predict accurately what the world's going to look like in 20 years. And we're in the midst of an election cycle that could have very different outcomes and with very different implications for the world. But in general, I have seen and continue to see a concentrated movement to take on this issue of climate change. And I think we will see a cleaner environment. I think we'll see a substantive reduction. We already have seen significant reductions in our carbon emissions, even without regulatory oversight. It's happening. It's going to be much better if we do have a national standard for these things. And by then we will. We will have some kind of a price on carbon. There will be a way to value clean energy over dirty energy. And how that is translated into the consumer remains to be seen. But it will happen, and that will result in behavioral changes that will drive ever cleaner atmosphere for all of us.
Well, Governor Whitman, it's been a pleasure to have you join us.
Always good to be here.
This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman.